Okay, we're going to continue with Biblical Prophecy and Postmillennialism. This is the 28th part overall, part 27 of Historical Expectations According to the Bible. It's part 6 of the Eschatology of the Book of Revelation because we are on chapter 6. As the controlling thought for this chapter, I want to read from Westminster Confession, chapter 3, section 2. This is a chapter of God's eternal decree. Although God knows whatsoever may or can come to pass upon all supposed conditions, yet has he not decreed anything because he foresaw it as future or as that which would come to pass upon such conditions. So, why do we bring that to your attention? Well, beginning with chapter 6, we're going to enter into that period of time between John and the end of the age. So beginning with chapter 6, we have to begin taking into account the unfolding of history as it was prophesied in the book of Revelation. It's important to note that God foresees everything future, foresaw what is now past to us, but was future to John, not simply because it might come to pass, could come to pass, or even would come to pass, but because it's what he's decreed will come to pass. So prophecy, from one point of view, represents the unfolding of the decree of God, which is why I've said several times, history is the best interpreter of prophecy. If prophecy is given with respect to future events, then once those future events have transpired, they're going to be the best indication that they have, in fact, transpired. Now, we've looked at the prospect of history from the throne room of God. God has decreed, and we've seen with John what everything looks like from God's point of view, if you will. We've also seen that it really falls to Christ, that all of the unfolding of the works of both creation and providence are predicated upon the mediation of Christ. He is the mediator. And he's the mediator of all things, including the unfolding of history. We saw that he was the only one who was able to unlock the book, really open the book. No one else could open it. They were not able to open the book. Only Christ was able to open that book. He was the only one worthy. The fact that he took upon himself our common humanity is precisely the basis upon which is predicated the revelation, and I would say all revelation to man. In other words, the condescension of God that we find in his word, the fact that God has condescended to reveal himself in his word, is predicated upon the fact that he's already condescended to take upon himself the nature of man. That was a much greater act of condescension when, as Paul says, the eternal Son of God emptied himself of all divine prerogative and made himself in the form of a slave or a servant by taking upon himself our common humanity. Now, he put aside all that was great about being God and took upon himself the nature of man and pledged himself to a life in a world that was, in fact, hobbled by sin. The fact that he's done that is also the mechanism, if you will, in and through which he is making known or can make known to us the thoughts of God. That is really the basis for all intelligible communication between God and man, which is why he's called the Word of God. Apart from the Son of God and this pledge of mediation, there'd be no meeting point. And if there was no meeting point, no mediation, then history would be an unlocked, or excuse me, a closed book, an unfathomable thing. We would look into the future. We would want to know something. People are always want to know what's happening tomorrow. God sees the future because he's decreed the future. That's the real basis for it. And the future is unfolded in Christ. So we're going to see a lot of, as we begin to look here, we're going to see a lot of earlier imagery starting to appear again. And we're going to have reason to recall what some of these things meant. The whole point of the revelation, in some respect, is there's a building. As we get further in, more and more things become intelligible. As more and more things are fulfilled, more and more things become intelligible. And it will be that way until the end. It's giving us a sort of a script, as I think I've said before. It's giving us a lot of high points, like a path through the woods, giving us different things that indicate we're on this track. This is how far we are. We're closing in on the home stretch and so on. You know, we're not yet to this, but we're past that. There are features, relief, events, or ideas. As we get past them, they should become more clear. As we approach them, they may seem to suggest themselves as more probable. But really, it's in retrospect that a lot of these things become relatively clear to us, or should be. Now, again, if we're going to take the view that some people have taken, that this is all referring to the destruction of Jerusalem, for example, we take the preterist view, we're going to tend to look at all of these events and try to put them all into that great event that happened in 70 AD when the Romans came and took away Jerusalem from the Jews and destroyed the temple and all of that. To do that, to take that point of view, is to miss the idea that there are, in fact, event horizons in the Bible. The reason why so much, for example, of Revelation might indeed point to specific things that occur at the time that Jerusalem is destroyed, is because there are, in all of God's judgments, similarities. And so if we look hard enough and we scrutinize, we think, we can find these things in all of the judgments of God. We can find certain elements, you know, the coming of enemies from afar, the destruction of, well, in the case of the temple, but in the destruction really of the church That occurs again and again. When the church is disobedient, it goes into captivity. When it's obedient, God redeems it again, brings it out of captivity. Those things are recurrent themes. And if we flatten our event horizon so as only to take in 70 AD, well, we might be tempted to put everything there. On the other hand, we can also flatten the event horizon by throwing everything to Judgment Day. And then we end up in various forms of amillennialism, or if we tend to view it in a little bit more of a dragged out fashion for other reasons, we can end up in various forms of premillennialism and even dispensationalism, depending on what we do with that event horizon. Historicism is saying, look, there are in fact different kinds of fulfillment with prophecies, and there is a reality in history, so that although there may be aspects, you know, to confuse what happened in 70 AD, for example, in Matthew 24, as we talked about some time ago, with the second coming, to think that one is the other is to confuse two event horizons. To understand that they're related to one another, as Matthew portrays in his gospel, is to understand that there's a common theme of divine judgment, and to understand that there is, in fact, a common promise to the people of God in the face of divine judgment. So we're going to treat this in an historical fashion. It's not to say that there aren't applications. That's not to say that people aren't going to try to idealize or try to preterize or try to futurize. What we're talking about, people do that all the time. I'm just saying I think they do that because in their mind, they only see one event horizon, whether it's destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD or Jesus coming at the end of time, or perhaps Jesus coming before the millennium, if you're a premillennialist. Those are all things that will cause you to read this in a distorted fashion. So we want to avoid that. With that said, I want to begin looking, first of all, at Revelation 6, 1.
Revelation 6, verse 1. And I saw when the Lamb opened one of the seals, and I heard as if it were a noise of thunder, one of the four beasts saying, "Come and see."
Okay, so there are three things we see here. But the first is this. If you remember that book, the book that needed to be opened, there are seven seals that have to be loosed in order to open the book. And once that's done, then we get to read the contents inside the book. So each seal, each thing that is going to make this an open book has to transpire before what we're about to encounter is going to become intelligible. I think the very fact that these are seals that need to be broken before the book can be opened is indicative of the fact that we need the passage of time. We need fulfillment and the passage of time so we can see these seals broken in succession before we can begin to understand what's really in the book. So we have to get a little bit beyond this. So starting here, it's only going to become intelligible as you get beyond the event horizon that is being talked about. And we'll see in the first, or in chapter 6, we're really going to see that a number of these seals are broken by the end of the chapter. So, the Lamb is the one opening the first seal, because he's the one, if you remember, who's worthy. He's the only one able to open this book. It's not going to make any sense outside of Christ. So people who approach the book of Revelation like Nostradamus, as if it's some sort of fortune-telling paper for headline news, those people are not necessarily approaching the book from the point of view that this is history as mediated in and through Christ. There's an idea that some people have that you can understand the Bible apart from being Christian. You really can't. There are things you can understand about it, but you can't really understand its meaning and its intent. There's a reason why unbelievers tend to focus on historical and grammatical criticism and don't tend to move on beyond that. They don't really get the gist of it. But the Lamb opening the first seal, that's because he's the only one worthy. Right? The second thing that we have noted is a noise of thunder. And that's the sound, really, of a voice. The noise of thunder is announcing judgment. The third thing noted here is the first beast saying, "Come and see." Now, if you remember from chapter 4, the first beast was the lion. And it's really, beast is not necessarily the best translation. It's a living thing. It's very different from the word used and translated beast later on in the book when we start talking about the beast and the false prophet and all of that. Different word. That means wild beast, and this word means living thing. And as I pointed out before, these four beasts were representative of the ministry. The lion in particular points to ministry that is bold and fearless. And that hearkening, come and see, is really giving a society through this ministry, this lion ministry, Christ is going to conquer providentially. So as that seal opens, that's the first note. All right, Revelation 6, 2.
Revelation 6, verse 2. "And I saw, and behold, a white horse, and he that sat on him had a bow, and a crown was given unto him, and he went forth conquering and to conquer."
Okay, so what does John see here? Well, he sees a white horse and the rider. And it's very significant. If that first beast, that first living thing, the lion ministry, if that is in fact announcing the coming of Christ and his providential conquering, this is really what is seen. The white horse and the rider and the bow and the crown are talking about both the military and the regal character of Christ. We're going to see that. Christ is both the Prince of Peace, but he's also the Lamb making war. He's the rider. And he's, we're told, going forth conquering and to conquer. He's going to conquer in opposition to both Jew and Gentile. Whoever wants to oppose him, he's going forth conquering and to conquer. That's really the beginning of the opening of that seal. And that's really the beginning, if you will. We're seeing right at the beginning the character of the Christian church around the time of John. It's around the end of the first century. The ministry is bold, it's fearless, and it's going to make tremendous inroads. In a very short period of time, fact, it's a period of time that I think is covered in this chapter. Christianity goes from being a small sect of a small religion, Hebrew religion, that manages to conquer an empire. And it does so not by arms, but through bold and fearless ministry, through all of the contendings that are going to transpire here, which we'll see in a moment. So, Revelation 6:3.
Revelation 6, verse 3. When he had opened the second seal, I heard the second beast say, "Come and see."
So here he sees the second seal now opening. And the beast in this case is the second beast. If you remember, the second beast was the ox or the calf. And it's about to enjoin patient continuance in the faith, in the face of what is coming here. So we end up, the church is beginning, John's age, it's fearless, it's bold. It begins to make all of the right moves into the empire. Christ himself is the one doing it, very much like we had with the conversion of Paul on the road to Damascus. We're going to see that by the end of this period, there's going to be another remarkable conversion in the history of the church, and it will have tremendous ramifications, very much like that. So we can see the supernatural element. The fact is, Christ is the one who's converting men. He's the one who's meeting with them. And so now, there's a second seal. And as the second seal is opened by the Lamb, again, we see Christ is the one who is in control of all of this. There is the beast, the living thing, the ministry, second representative of the ministry. And this is the one enjoining patient continuance. You've got to remain sure and steady in the face of what's coming. What's coming is actually spelled out in verse 4. Revelation 6:4.
Revelation 6:4. And there went out another horse that was red, and the power was given to him that sat thereon to take peace from the earth, and that they should kill one another, and that there was given unto him a great sword.
Yeah, the fact is that there's a red horse John sees now. Note, only the white horse has a rider. The red horse does not have a rider. You don't see a red horse or a rider on the red horse. But ultimately, it's Christ who is leading this charge, if you will. So the white horse is going first, conquering to conquer. And in his wake, what is happening? Well, we're told that he's taking peace from the earth. Remember, Jesus said, "I didn't come to bring peace, but to bring a sword. You know, set children against their parents and parents against their children, husbands against wives, brother against sister, and all of that sort of thing." He's come to upset the existing order. And Christianity, the advent of Christianity is going to do just that. So, in conjunction with the going forth of the gospel, it turns out that we enter a period of time in the early days of the church when war is in fact relatively commonplace. There are a lot of wars going on at this time. And in particular, these wars are wreaking desolation on the Jews, the Romans, and the Christians. It's an across-the-board decimation. It's having a deleterious effect. It's not a good thing. These wars are, in fact, causing people great hardship throughout the empire. That is, the Roman Empire, in particular. But Christianity is spreading. The Roman Empire is in its death throes, in some respects. Rome is under assault, internally and externally. It's affecting everyone in the empire. That's why this second beast, the ox or the calf, that is representing that patient continuance. You need to be patient. You need to hold on. Now, the great problem that people have is they tend to see things only in terms of their own lives. You know, your lifetime is really your event horizon. And a lot of people view it that way. They don't really consider the past. They don't think a whole lot about the future. But prophecy in the Bible is meant to make you think about the future and to make you think about the past, to make you consider your place in that continuum. So there's a counsel here to be patient. And you're going to need that patience in the early days of the church in particular here because of the unrest. Yes, Christianity has been unleashed in the world, but war has been unleashed as well. Peace is going to be taken from the earth. And the reason is that very seldom are there great changes in empire apart from war. There's going to be a big change presently in the state of things in the world. If we're getting close to the millennium, I would expect that we're going to hear not only of rumors of war, but actually of war as well. War upsets the psychological comfort of man. And it puts man in a position of, in some cases, very directly facing mortality and judgment. In other cases, they just don't have the distractions they had in peacetime. But here we have wars going forth, and this is part of the opening of the seals. Revelation 6:5.
Revelation 6, verse 5. And when he had opened the third seal, I heard the third beast say, "Come and see." And I beheld, and lo, a black horse, and he that sat on him had a pair of balances in his hand.
He that sat on him had a pair of balances in his hand. Black horse apparently has a rider. Not mentioned with the red horse, so we don't really know if he does or not. It doesn't appear to. Nonetheless, the Lamb opens the third seal. There's a black horse. The third beast is the beast that resembled a man, that third living thing. So here's the ministry indicating active sympathy and counsel and exhortation. There's an empathy for man. And there's an empathy for man because, as we see here, war is not all that is coming. The fact is that in the tale of war, very common feature of war is scarcity. So you have a pair of balances in the hand of the one on the on the back of that black horse. And that actually points us to verse 6.
Revelation 6:6. I heard a voice in the midst of the four beasts say, a measure of wheat for a penny, and three measures of barley for a penny. And see thou heard not the oil and the wine.
Yeah, there we have the kind of famine scarcity that follows war. And it's actually pretty well known that from about the year 138 AD to right around 300 AD was a period of great scarcity because of war. The war had brought them to the desolating after effects of war, famine, scarcity. You know, several things happen in wars. Not only are crops routinely destroyed by invading armies, they eat it all. You know, armies march on their stomachs. But they don't tend to plant what they've harvested. So there's not going to be much to go in the next year. They may not have even left enough seed in order to carry on. On top of that, you've got the problem of areas where invading and marauding armies appear are very often decimated. People tend to leave where there's fighting. They tend to flock to other places that are close, that maybe are not under siege. What happens is then you meet with scarcity of resources, especially if people are crowding into cities. Especially at a time like this. You need a lot of people raising a lot of food in an agrarian situation to take care of all of the needs, even in these smaller cities. There's a lot of people working. Well, if those people leave their fields because they're in fear of their lives, say they leave off raising food, if the armies are eating the food, this can have not only can it have deleterious effects, harmful effects on the prospect of more food going forward, but it also can have generational effect when you uproot people and move them from one place to another, when an army, when fighting goes on. You know, very often takes several generations for people to move back into an area that's been heavily damaged in battle. You know, people who move out are not quick to move back in. And the net result at this time, between 138 and 300, was that there was great scarcity throughout the empire. They were experiencing famine, exactly what you would expect on the heels of war. Now, these are all things that are being unleashed as the Book of Providence is being opened, right? As Providence is being opened, as prophecy is being unfolded. Revelation 6:7.
Revelation 6:7, and when he had opened the fourth seal, I heard the voice of the fourth beast say, come and see.
Here again, the Lamb is opening the fourth seal. We're now up to the fourth seal. And the fourth beast is the one that, the living thing that looked like the eagle, the face like the eagle, which is enjoining in us a spiritual mindedness. It's really telling us to look beyond, to consider, in fact, something more than this earth. So, as the gospel is being preached, as these seals are unfolding, the world itself is falling into disarray. Rome is being shaken. The Roman Empire is being shaken by war, by famine, And ultimately, as we'll see with regard to the opening of the fourth seal, pestilence. You know, that's what's coming. We shouldn't be, again, surprised when these things happen. You know, that's the natural course of war. So on the one hand, what we're told is that in the early days of the church, there will be this bold and fearless preaching of the gospel going forth, and concurrently, there's going to be war. It's going to be followed by famine. And it's going to be met with pestilence. If we look at Revelation 6:8.
Revelation 6:8, and I looked, and behold, a pale horse. And his name that sat on him was Death, and hell followed with him. And power was given unto them over the fourth part of the earth, to kill with the sword, and with hunger, and with death, and with the beasts of the earth.
Yeah, and if the red horse doesn't tell us who or what was riding it, doesn't appear to have a rider, the one representing war, if the black horse has some sort of rider representing famine, when we get to the pale horse, or the grizzled horse, it has a rider. It too has a rider, and the name of the rider of this horse is Death. And his mission, as I said, is to kill the fourth part of the earth. To kill with sword, with hunger, and with death, and with the beasts of the earth. This is really, if we see what's going on, the power actually that's given unto them, unto these three horses in particular, is to bring destruction to a fourth part of the earth. To do so with war, famine, and pestilence. And so, we know that from about 211 to 270 AD, there were great depopulations of people throughout the empire. And it was due to pestilence. You know, war brings famine. The famine brings malnutrition. Malnutrition tends to bring pestilence. The other thing is, it's mentioned in this verse, are the beasts. And, you know, when there are war zones, as civilization breaks down, as the competition for food, available food, goes up, it tends to bring people into conflict with wild animals. We end up entering a very primitive state of being in which we find ourselves in all kinds of competition for food, not least of which is wild animals. There have been different times in the history of the world where wild animals have caused ravaging damage to various populations. They do it in two ways. They attack humans, but even if they're not attacking humans, if you're trying to raise livestock, you're trying to raise a garden. And here in Pennsylvania, if you're trying to raise a garden up in the mountains, if you don't put fences up so high, the deer will ravage it. So this is going to be a problem. If you're already starving, you're trying to raise food, to be facing off famine and then have animals competing for the little bit of food that's available, that's just creating another problem. So between 211 and 270 AD, there were, in fact, a lot of people carried away by death. There were great depopulations in the empire, and that weakens the empire from within. You know, part of the discouragement, if you're standing outside of Rome, if you are one of what they would have called the barbarian tribes, you are looking at Rome and you say, boy, even if I get past those first guards, there are just a gazillion Romans behind all those walls, and some of them are armed. This is not going to be easy. We're going to meet with people everywhere, and they're not going to be happy to see us. They think we're barbarians. That situation, when they look and see that there have been great depopulations, puts the entire empire at risk. They see that there's something killing you off from inside. There aren't as many people at the gate anymore. You know, they know you're starving. They know you're having trouble. And this stuff does not go on for centuries without people outside of your camp finding out you're having serious existential problems. And that's leading up to something. Remember, too, that we're now at the end of, if you remember Daniel's beasts, and Daniel's, or Nebuchadnezzar's image, we're at the point where we're getting into the disintegration of the Roman Empire. You know, it's heading for dissolution. It's not able to stand together very well. So that's part of what is happening here, too. So this is, again, the earlier ages of the church. That's what we're talking about. Look at Revelation 6, 9.
Revelation 6, verse 9. When he had opened the fifth seal, I saw under the altar the souls of them that were slain for the word of God and for the testimony which they held.
Yeah, again, the Lamb, you see the Lamb revealed here opening the fifth seal. Now what happens? Well, all of a sudden, we're given a little bit of a different view of things. Remember, this is all prior to, these seven seals have to be broken before the book is opened. So that's why I say this is all happening sort of in conjunction, one with another, or concurrently. The vision now is really oriented toward heaven. We're looking at souls under the altar in heaven, and they're there for their testimony, which means this. These are the martyrs of God. The first four seals are telling us what's happening on earth during this period of time. This fourth seal is now telling us, or fifth seal, I should say, is telling us that, by the way, there's something going on in heaven while this is going on earth. Heaven is not silent. The church is in a very challenged state on earth. It's bold, it's fearless, it's advancing. Needs to be patient in continuance in the face of war. Right? It needs to be sympathetic. They need to bear up one another, exhorting one another as they see the famine progressing. They need to be spiritually minded. And so now this fifth seal is giving us a little bit of a glimpse of what it means to be spiritually minded with respect to this. How do we perceive? How should we understand the events that are transpiring on earth? You know, on the one hand, the church may say, hey, we see tremendous progress, right? We're preaching, it's conquering. We're going forth conquering and to conquer. On the other hand, the empire is falling to pieces, and that may not bode so well. What's going on? Well, now we see the souls who are under the altar in heaven for their testimony, and that means we're talking about martyrs of God. We're talking about early martyrs. So these are people who've been put to death for the faith. And what do we see about them? Well, look at Revelation 6:10.
Revelation 6, verse 10. And they cried with a loud voice, saying, "How long, O Lord, holy and true, dost thou not judge and avenge our blood on them that dwell on the earth?"
They're crying out for the justice of God. I want to look at Luke 11:51 as well here.
Luke 11:51. From the blood of Abel unto the blood of Zechariah, which perished between the altar and the temple, verily I say unto you, it shall be required of this generation.
So they're crying out for justice. They're crying out for the vengeance of God against their enemies. All of this blood from Abel to Zechariah, son of Berechiah, that was required of the Jews, and that was directly related to the fall of Jerusalem. But if that was required of Jews, who were the people of God, who bore responsibility, how much more is this blood requirement going to fall on those who are pagan, the heathen nations, the heathen empires? Now, we've seen the Babylonian Empire fall. We've seen the Medo-Persian Empire fall. We've seen the Greek Empire fall. Now it's time for the Roman Empire to fall. It's heading down. And the reason it's heading down, spiritually speaking, we see war, famine, pestilence. What we may not have been aware of is that the church triumphant, the martyrs under the altar, they're praying down the wrath of God against the enemies of the church. So we need to balance what we see. You know, it looks bad when we see all the war. It looks bad when we see the famine. It looks horrible when we see the pestilence. We see all these depopulations going on. We need to step back and take a deep breath and realize this is all part of God's plan, his design. The martyrs, the souls of the martyrs are crying out for justice. Look at Revelation 6:11.
Revelation 6:11. White robes were given unto every one of them, and it was said unto them that they should rest yet for a little season, until their fellow servants also had their brethren that should be killed as they were should be fulfilled.
Okay, so the point is here that as we contemplate them, as we contemplate these early martyrs of the church, they're eager to see the fruit of their martyrdom in the betterment of the church. They want to know when God will avenge. We're told that the time of justice, though it's seemingly being delayed, it's certain. They're just awaiting the full number of martyrs to come in. That is, for this period of time. So, part of the church, the early church's arsenal, was martyrdom. Martyrdom is a very important thing in the history of Christianity. It's been one of the things that's helped move forward the cause of the church again and again. It's one of those things that demands the justice of God. Remember, you can't shed innocent blood without that blood crying out for vengeance. And if you are, in fact, a martyr for the cause of God, that's having your blood shed for that cause is placing a stake in the ground, if you will, a marker. And it's a stake from which the church is being pulled forward in history. It's important what they've done. There's a reason why It was said in the early church that the blood of the martyrs is a seed of the church. You know, their blood is, in fact, leading to the increase of the church. The more the church is being persecuted during this period, the more it's growing. They're not backing away from what they're preaching or what they're teaching. They're pressing into it. They're pressing into all the persecution that they face. And at the same time that they're facing all of that, and this, again, is all a matter of history, the Roman Empire is in trouble. It's beleaguered with war, and it's having all kinds of problems with famine and pestilence. Now, this seal, under the seal, we see that the time of all of this is, in fact, very limited. It's not going to go on forever. It may seem like a long period of time. It may seem like it should have been over sooner. But it's not. And again, I think we need to step back and ask ourselves, when we're looking at various features of prophecy, are we so focused on these that we perceive that they must be fulfilled in our time when, in fact, they may not be? You know, the fulfillment is what's certain. It may seem to us as if it's not happening quickly enough. We want it to be over. We want to move on. That's not the way the history of the church is falling out. There are a lot of things that have to transpire. And by opening this seal, what we see is that there's a consideration that you may not have thought on very hard or very much. Right? There are martyrs crying out for vengeance on the one hand, but on the other hand, there are still people who are dying that are trying to set forward the cause of the agenda of the church at this time. We need to keep that in mind. Even if you're the soul under the altar, when God's purpose, when the time of his purpose is right, it's going to happen. Be sure, be certain, these things will be fulfilled. If they're not fulfilled in your timing, it doesn't mean that they're not going to be fulfilled. And timing, when it comes to prophecy, especially when we get outside of certain grand features, it gets harder and harder to say exactly when something begins and when something ends. And mainly, I think it has to do with the fact that there are multiple event horizons. There's one fulfillment which always will be the one that I think gives meaning to all of the rest. And frankly, ultimately, that one is Judgment Day. That's what gives meaning to all of the other judgments of God in history. You know, and just like the fullness of redemption on Judgment Day for the people of God gives meaning to all the promises that go before. So there's a time of justice, very clear. It appears to them to be delayed, but it is certain. We know that much. Okay, we want to move on to Revelation 6, 12 through 14.
Revelation 6, verses 12 through 14. And I beheld when he had opened the sixth seal, and lo, there was a great earthquake. And the sun became black as sackcloth of hair, and the moon became as blood. And the stars of the heaven fell unto the earth, even as a fig tree casteth her untimely figs when she is shaken of a mighty wind. And the heaven departed as a scroll when it is rolled together, and every mountain and island were moved out of their places.
Okay, so what do we have here? Well, we have Again, the Lamb opening now the sixth seal. And under that, we have a great earthquake. The language of the earthquake, the sun becoming black as sackcloth, moon like blood, stars of heaven falling to the earth, and all of that. We're talking about the turmoil, the overturning of empires here. Talking about the shaking of the nations going on at this point. This is all symbolic language. It was a great earthquake, and the great earthquake actually represents the prayer of the souls that are under the altar being answered. And when judgment comes, it comes as a result of fulfillment of their prayers, or answer to the prayers, I should say. The answer to their prayers is an answer that's going to bring an end. And what it's describing here, the great earthquake, is that thing. Remember, you know, in that image that Daniel has, or Nebuchadnezzar had in the four beasts, we're to that last great empire that is to be destroyed by the coming of Christ. He's going to strike it on its feet. That's what's in view. The end of the Roman Empire is what's in view here. That's what's being shaken by all of this. You know, it's being shaken inside and out. Christianity has arisen in its bosom. This preaching, these Christians are going everywhere. They won't stop. They won't shut up. They're taking this message everywhere through the empire. And it's having an effect. Remember, just by the end of the New Testament, Paul has already gotten to Rome. He's already talking to people who are in high places. He's, in fact, witnessing to very high-ranking Roman citizens. Now, this process is going on through these first centuries of the church. That's going on the inside. On the outside, they're being shaken by all these wars. And then they have to face famine and pestilence. But the effects of this are not all at once. It's cumulative. It's building. So the language employed, really, these are symbols of revolutions and changes amongst nations. And particularly, again, we're talking about the Roman Empire. We're talking about Rome as she is the mistress of the nations of the earth. And all of the peoples of the earth are doing homage to Rome at this time. You want anything? You want anything done? Call Rome. Rome is where things get done. Rome is how things get done. You know, there's nothing you can do as a nation at this time on any kind of scale without taking into account what Rome thinks about it, what they're going to do. Sort of like people today in the world. It's very hard for nations to act unilaterally. Ask Iran. They had to wait on the United States to approve what they were allowed to do with their nuclear facilities. The fact is, most nations, when there are empires in the world, cannot act unilaterally. They can only act bilaterally. They have to consult with the empire. America is an empire now. But the fact is, at this time, it was Rome. And Rome required a certain degree of compliance for its client states. Now, with all between the preaching of Christianity and all of these other factors, war, famine, pestilence, that resolve is weakening. The old Roman order, and as things weaken, you know, the old guard, one old guard falls, another tries to prop it up. You have all kinds of contests going on. So that's what we see happening here. All right, Revelation 6, 15 to 17.
Revelation 6, 15 to 17.
And the kings of the earth and the great men and the rich men and the chief captains and the mighty men and every bondman and every free man hid themselves in the dens and in the rocks of the mountains and said to the mountains and rocks, fall on us and hide us from the face of him that sitteth on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb. For the great day of his wrath is come, and who shall be able to stand?
And these verses are really, they do bear respect to the preceding verses because they're really giving interpretation to them. They're telling us that this, the sun becoming black and as sackcloth of hair, and the moon as blood, and the stars of heaven falling under the earth, and so on. We're talking about the kings of the earth, the great men, the rich men, the chief captains. You know, as this world is falling apart, they're looking for some way out. And ultimately, you know, this is representing the wrath of the Lamb. You know, again, what was it that was prophesied in Daniel? That little stone cut without hands would become a great mountain, that he would smash the feet of that image that that Nebuchadnezzar had, and that it would fall. He would crush them to powder. He would bring them down. And that's what's happening. You know, no one ever thought that the Roman Empire would come down. But they're not fighting against men. They're fighting against Christ, ultimately. And they're fighting against him because they're set at odds against him. So he's fighting them providentially. You know, they ultimately, they're saying to the mountains and the rocks, fall on us and hide us from the face of him that sitteth on the throne. Who is that? It's Jesus. From the wrath of the Lamb. It's Christ. All right, The great day of his wrath has come. Who shall be able to stand? That's their question. And that really is a question, as all of this is going on, that's the question on the lips of the early church as the Roman Empire is crumbling. Who can stand? And the answer ultimately is God's elect. The answer to that question is only going to be resolved through the hearing of the preaching of the Word of God. So, to summarize, then, the period of the six seals, I think we're talking about the portion of history, the history of the church, that extends itself from John, 95-ish AD, until somewhere around the time of 300 to 325 AD, the time of Constantine, when the Roman Empire is, in fact, converted to Christ. We're right up at the edge of that. And just like Paul on the road to Damascus, Constantine is going to have his own experience very much like that. And he will almost overnight go from being a professed heathen to a professed Christian. We can debate the reality of the Christianity and all of that. That would be another consideration, another time, another place. In terms of the history of the church, and that's what the book of Revelation is about, the conversion of Constantine, which his conversion and his turning to Christianity really is culminated in the Council of Nicaea in 325, when the church first puts down the Arian heresy. So it's a remarkable change for the outward estate of the church. The church goes from being a persecuted minority and even maybe a burgeoning, sizable minority to being the majority in the empire. And there is a new infusion of stability in the Roman Empire as a result of this. So we're moving from about 95 AD, John's time, when he's seeing this vision. Now we're up to approximately 325 AD. Now we're right about there, because the question is about to be answered with regard to who shall be able to stand. And that's a really good question if you consider the desperate estate just prior to Constantine's conversion. Things looked pretty bad in their own way. The church may have been spiritually pure, but it was having serious existential problems. And if the Roman Empire had gone, there's no telling where that would have led. All right. With that, we will conclude for today. Next time, we'll pick up Revelation 7, and we'll start talking about, hopefully, some more interesting things in the history of the church.
Stillwater's Revival Books is now located at puritandownloads.com. It's your worldwide online Reformation home for the very best in free and discounted classic and contemporary Puritan and Reformed books, MP3s, and videos. For much more information on the Puritans and Reformers, including the best free and discounted classic and contemporary books, MP3s, digital downloads, and videos, please visit Stillwater's Revival Books at puritandownloads.com. Stillwater's Revival Books also publishes the Puritan Hard Drive, the most powerful and practical Christian study tool ever produced. All thanks and glory be to the mercy, grace, and love of the Lord Jesus Christ for this remarkable and wonderful new Christian study tool. The Puritan Hard Drive contains over 12,500 of the best Reformation books, MP3s, and videos ever gathered onto one portable Christian study tool. An extraordinary collection of Puritan, Protestant, Calvinistic, Presbyterian, Covenanter, and Reformed Baptist resources. It's fully upgradable and it's small enough to fit in your pocket. The Puritan Hard Drive combines an embedded database containing many millions of records with the most amazing and extraordinary custom Christian search and research software ever created. The Puritan Hard Drive has been produced to assist you in the fascinating and exhilarating spiritual, intellectual, familial, ecclesiastical, and societal adventure that is living the Christian life. It has been specifically designed so that you might more faithfully know, serve, and love the Lord Jesus Christ, as well as to help you to do all you can to bring glory to His great name. If you want to love God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind, then the Puritan Hard Drive is for you. Visit puritandownloads.com today for much more information on the Puritan Hard Drive and to take advantage of all the free and discounted Reformation and Puritan books, MP3s, and videos that we offer at Stillwater's Revival Books.